From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Birock, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Last month, Arizona voters approved an increase in the minimum wage. Today, a report on the economics of that increase. An interview with the University of Arizona art professor who's being honored for her contribution to the second wave of feminism, a feature story on Mangate Square, and a conversation with the star of the musical Ella, currently playing here in Tucson. Those stories and more are coming up, but first. Last month, Arizona voters approved an increase in the state minimum wage. But what does that mean for Arizona's economy? Christopher Conover reports.
On January 1st, workers earning minimum wage in Arizona get a raise from $5.15 to $6.75 an hour. But John Doherty with the Tucson Chamber of Commerce, which campaigned against Prop 202, says they foresee bad results for some employees when the new wage kicks in.
The minimum wage was designed to be a starting wage for people just getting their foot in the door of employment. And I would imagine that we're going to see a lot of businesses cut back on those entry-level jobs, and it's going to hurt young people trying to get some experience so they can move up the wage ladder. Studies have shown that in other states where they faced a huge increase of this type, that's the first people to get the axe are at the lower end of the economic ladder.
Doherty also sees another problem. An increase in the minimum wage, he says, could hurt the competitive climate in Arizona.
This will put us at an economic disadvantage. Businesses, their main expense is labor, and they want to make sure that they can have the capital to expand and perform for their customers or clients. And if that labor cost is through the roof, they're going to look at another state to locate in: Utah, Colorado, New Mexico. We could lose out on some economic opportunities here in Arizona.
Further complicating the minimum wage picture is the new Congress. Capitol Hill watchers expect the new Democratic Congress to quickly raise the federal minimum wage to $7.25 an hour, the first increase since the late 1990s. That means that Arizona could end up raising what they pay employees twice in rapid succession, according to Doherty.
Now, if that happens, it's going to be a double whammy against a business owner.
Arizona's new minimum wage is indexed to inflation, so it increases every year, which means in just a few short years, it could pass the federal minimum wage, which means businesses in the state would once again have to pay at the increasing state rate. So we asked Dr. Alexander Sugiyama with the UA Department of Economics what exactly that means for the economy of the Grand Canyon state.
Well, in general, the standard economic view about minimum wages is the higher the minimum wage, the more employers are going to hire people, or the fewer jobs there are going to be. So if the minimum wage goes up dramatically, then there will be some jobs that the contribution that the employee can make isn't larger than the cost of the employee. So employees get priced out of the labor market. So one of the challenges in the recent increase in the minimum wage is it a big enough one that's going to happen, or is it small enough so that there won't be this job loss?
So in other words, only time will tell. Economics and politics are often tied together, especially in the area of immigration. And the minimum wage increase could bring a collision of those two areas once again, according to Dr. Sugiyama.
As a state that has a large undocumented worker population, all of a sudden you might start to see people have an incentive to hire undocumented workers, because if you're breaking the law anyway, now it's even cheaper for you to break the law. So I think that's a concern that people have, and that would be rather unfortunate if the minimum wage actually has that unintended consequence.
When you break the minimum wage down by the numbers, at the old rate of $5.15 an hour, a worker earns just under $11,000 a year. The new rate of $6.75 would take that to $14,000 a year. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
Up next on Arizona Spotlight, an interview with the University of Arizona art professor who's featured in a new book about pioneering feminists. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. Thank you. Some consider the second wave of feminism to be the largest social movement in American history. It was a time when the role of women in Western culture changed forever. University of Arizona art professor Barbara Rogers has been included in the recently published Feminist Who Changed America, 1963 to 1975, edited by Barbara J. Love. It's said to be the first comprehensive directory to document the leaders of the women's movement and tells the stories of 2,000 women who fostered permanent change of entrenched customs and laws. Barbara Rogers joins me now in our studios. Barbara, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me, Julie.
In the book, you're being called a pioneering feminist. Tell me first about the female role in the art world during the 60s and 70s. It was quite a struggle for you, wasn't it?
I think that you were just always treated as somebody passing through, that you were going to get married, have kids, and disappear into the middle class, never to make another painting. I think that's sort of generally how women were treated, not badly, just ignored.
Where did you study?
I studied at Ohio State University, and I graduated from there in the morning, got married that afternoon, and left for California that night. And there I went to the San Francisco Art Institute, where I studied with, if you can call it that, Richard Diebenkorn and Elmer Bischoff and Frank Lobdell. Really, really amazing, wonderful artists, but not great at teaching, not at that time anyway. They kind of liked hanging out with each other out in the hall and grunted their approval, or their suggestions were pretty monosyllabic. And I then switched to the University of California at Berkeley, where I hoped everybody would be more verbal and more helpful, because it was my hard-earned money, not my parents, and I wanted someone to give me what I didn't get at Ohio State, which was contemporary painting, abstract expressionism, all the exciting things in the air in the early 60s.
And who was it that told you that women would never teach art at the university level?
The dean at the University of California at Berkeley. After I won the Eisner Prize in painting, my husband and I were thrilled that I'd won this award. And my husband stated, well, this is great because it'll give her maybe an advantage when it comes to getting a teaching job. And the dean sort of chuckled and said, oh, no, I don't think so. I think it'll probably not be in my lifetime. And he was a young dean. He wasn't old. So his lifetime had, you know, quite a bit ahead of him before they ever hire women to teach on the university level.
And why was that? It doesn't seem that the art world would be that male-dominated, that there wouldn't be a place for women.
Probably lots of fields from the outside don't look like that's how they would be. But the truth is, it took a Senate subcommittee coming on the campus at UC Berkeley to force them to hire women, not just in art, but in many of the disciplines. They wanted to help their graduate students who had kids, that were married and had kids, because they thought if you were a woman, you would marry someone and they would take care of you. It's hard to believe that now, you know, in 2000, almost 2007. But in the 60s, that's how it was. Lots of women married lots of nice men and expected to be taken care of and not to have to go get a full-time job, that they could maybe just go paint. And that would actually give them an advantage.
You're included in the book mostly for refusing to back down on a recommendation that an arts award in San Francisco be given to a female artist. You were fairly persistent in that matter. Can you explain that for me?
That's a funny story. because I was a young mom, I offered to cook if they would hold the meeting at my house. So there were two guys, and we had dinner. They had their candidates. Each one of them had a really good candidate that happened to be male. My candidate was a woman who I felt deserved the award because she was outstanding and had already been given a little bit of a show at the Whitney when she was a student. And Joan Brown was her name, an amazing, amazing artist. So about 5 hours later, people were all exhausted. And one of them said, "Oh, what the hell? Give it to Barbara's candidate because she cooked." And I don't think Joan Brown was ever told. I would never have told her of what the true story was, that she got the amazing Adeline Kent Award.
And she was the first female artist.
Yeah. And, you know, that money was put in trust by a woman artist. And I'm sure Adeline Kent assumed that there would be fairness and that it would be an maybe not an even distribution, but that women wouldn't be eliminated from consideration. But if you didn't put a woman on the award jury, on that panel, then it's going to go to somebody's buddy. Worthy, you know, I'm not saying that. But certainly not a level playing field.
Well, how do you see the role of women in the arts world today? You've seen a big change from the 60s to now, of course.
Well, there's a lot more women in art schools than there are men. So I think it's very important that they have role models, that the very sight of a woman doing what it is you love and what you want to do with your life, I think just says all that anybody needs to say, that you look at that person and you say, "Oh, I get it. I can do that." So I think that we have a way to go in the private sector with the galleries. You know, it's truly that saying of "you've come a long way, baby, but you've got a long way to go." That's true now, but we have come such a long way, and that's only a good thing.
Barbara Rogers, thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Stay tuned to Arizona Spotlight. When we continue, Tony Paniagua has a feature story on Main Gate Square. You're listening to Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. The Main Gate Square is a successful shopping area located near the University of Arizona campus. It's owned by the Marshall Foundation. And as Tony Paniagua reports, Main Gate Square is not just a place to shop.
Just a few feet away from the University of Arizona, you'll find a pedestrian-friendly area in the middle of the city. It's called Main Gate Square, and many people believe it has an urban feel, a tiny taste of New York City, San Francisco, or Europe. The sidewalks here are wider than most in the rest of the city, and as you take a leisurely stroll, you'll see about 50 potted plants around you, hanging baskets with flowers above you, and approximately 25 outdoor seating areas surrounding you. But this is more than a shopping destination. Most of the property here, on University Drive between Park Avenue and Euclid, is owned and run by the Marshall Foundation. The foundation uses some of the profits to help the community. Jane McCullum is the executive director.
The Marshall Foundation gets all of its income from its rentals, and the IRS requires that we donate 5% of our fair market value, which is technically the value of our real estate. And so it doesn't matter to the IRS whether we're making money or not. And currently we're giving away around $800,000 a year. 50% of that goes to the University of Arizona, most of that in the form of scholarships.
It all started as an idea by Louise Marshall and her mother. Marshall came from a wealthy family in Boston, and she moved here more than 100 years ago for health reasons. She began her graduate studies at the University of Arizona and eventually became the university's first female professor.
And she started buying up the land in and around the university in 1905. And started renting it and started making money. And her mother had embedded in her a sense of service, and so she decided she would form the foundation, and the rents from her tenants would serve as the income to give the money away.
Now, people like Kelly Podorsik are investing their money in the neighborhood. When Podorsik worked in the international auto industry, she traveled around the world and visited many spots. She worked on a business plan for a year and recently opened her own company, Salud Spa Bar. Podorsik moved here from Los Angeles, and she sells fragrances, soaps, and other items.
Through my studies, I learned that Tucson is one of the spa capitals of the world. A lot of new spa trends are born here in Tucson, with Canyon Ranch and Miraval. And so I decided to relocate to Tucson because I know if my business can work here, it can work anywhere.
Sean Patel and his family also recently set up shop in the neighborhood. They sell merchandise from Life is Good, a company that incorporated in Boston.
We decided this would be perfect with the amount of foot traffic, especially in front of the U of A, to spread, you know, optimism. That is the mantra of Life is Good. It surprised me that nobody knew about Main Gate, but now we're kind of on the map, Main Gate, because everybody knows about us, because Life is Good is here, Ed Hardy, American Apparel, and all these other Urban Outfitters is here. So it's kind of mimicking Mill Ave in Phoenix. So, you know, that was kind of the hip area a couple years ago, but now it's kind of come down to Tucson.
On a recent sunny afternoon with clear blue skies and comfortable temperatures, we spoke to a visitor from Europe. Patrick Bogart came to Tucson from the Netherlands. We asked him about Main Gate Square.
I like it very much, especially with this weather. It's nothing more nice to sit outside and drink a coffee or have lunch or talk with friends. And don't know how characteristic this is for Tucson or just general in the U.S. In other cities, I've seen much less places outside to sit and drink.
Pia McGowan was also spending some time in the neighborhood. She lives in Tucson.
I like it. I think it's lively, and I like the shops. I think there's fun shops, good places to eat.
Do you come here often?
Not as often as I'd like, actually.
And supporters are optimistic about the future. Since the Marriott was built here in the 1990s as a conference hotel near the university, interest in this urban destination has been growing. There's even valet parking for those who prefer the convenience. Marshall Foundation Executive Director Jane McCollum.
It's fun. It's for all ages. I think people think that it's a university street. It's not at all. You see people with strollers. You see older people who just like to walk. It's the neighborhood's shopping center as well as the University of Arizona's downtown.
And business owner Sean Patel is also a fan of the area.
It's kind of a family atmosphere, you know, because a lot of the people that come into the store live around here, and it's kind of like a nucleus where, you know, people come in here and shop, and then they kind of spread the word about Main Gate.
And merchants hope the word continues to spread, inspiring others to enjoy urban infill with a few friends and conversation. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Tony Paniagua.
In the near future, the Marshall Foundation hopes to build a 6-to-8-screen movie theater near the Marriott Hotel. The plan is to dedicate 2 theaters to the University of Arizona's Media Arts Department so students can get real-life experience and show some of their films. For more information about Main Gate Square, you can log on to maingatesquare.com. Up next, Mark McLemore interviews the star of the musical Ella, currently playing here in Tucson. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ.
For more than 50 years, Ella Fitzgerald was the most popular female jazz singer in the country. Dubbed the First Lady of Song, she won 13 Grammy Awards and sold over 40 million albums. She sang with the greats, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Nat King Cole, and Frank Sinatra, among others. And when she opened her mouth, her sultry voice sang the notes of sweet jazz, imitating every instrument in the orchestra. A new musical currently playing in Tucson celebrates her talent and reveals the highs and lows of her career. Mark McLemore recently sat down with Tina Fabrique, a Tony-nominated actress and the star of the show. Her voice is familiar to millions of Reading Rainbow fans on PBS. She sang the theme song. She currently portrays the First Lady of Song in the musical simply titled Ella.
Good morning, Tina. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about Ella. Tell me, what are some of the qualities about her that you think helped to make her the First Lady of Song?
First of all, I think her commitment to the music, her beautiful vocal instrument, very unusual. She could sing a straight line. She could sing out of the phone book, and you'd remember hearing it. Her I think she had perfect pitch. Some people would argue that, but I think she had perfect pitch or at least relative pitch. And her freeness and openness, even though people only think of her as the lady that sang all these songbooks, which are pretty staid and just melodic and beautiful, she had a whole series of encounters with wonderful horn players that she actually, I think, was one of them. She felt she was a horn player. And so she had an era of bop music that was just fabulous. So at that turn, she was just leaping into this improvisational kind of interpretation of jazz with people like Dizzy Gillespie and Louis Armstrong being someone that she looked up to. So she had a very full, rich well to draw from.
And in the play, you perform Ella. What stage in her career are we seeing Ella at, and what is the setting of the play?
This happens around her performance in Nice. Actually, it's around the time that her sister Frances passed away. And in Nice, her manager, Norman Granz, decided he wanted to film that performance. So you can imagine that she had to fly home for 3 days, bury her sister, come back, and do this concert. That is really the crux of the pain and decision-making that she had to really come under.
So the play looks at her life on stage and also off stage.
Yeah, she revisits many of the things that brought her to that place where she started singing, how she got started in her career, meeting Norman Granz, working with people like Chick Webb and Louis Armstrong. She revisits all of that. And then the second half is really the concert in Nice, the Riviera Tour, that allows you to see how she kind of gets through it with all of this hanging over her head.
Mm-hmm. And gives you a chance to sing some of the great tunes
the greatest songs.
Was doing at that era.
Yeah.
What kind of a band are you going to have behind you?
I have a 4-piece band, bass, drums, piano, and trumpet. It allows me enough to really do some of the richest arrangements. Danny Holgate was the musical arranger on this piece, and he did some fabulous arrangements. And I think what it does is it gives you a real feel for, it allows her to do some of the scat tunes like Flying Home and How High the Moon, which are scats that people really recognize. Jazz lovers really hear it and say, oh yeah, you know, I remember hearing that over and over again. Mm-hmm. So it's a unit that is really powerful, yet it's small enough to really work in all the different stages that we're going to be performing.
Well, I know that you've had a lot of Broadway experience, but what else in your career prepared you to play Ella? Like, what sort of things were you able to draw on that you felt you had in common with Ella when you took on the role?
Well, I guess one of the first things is that I also sang at the Apollo. I'm born and raised in New York, in Harlem. And when I was 16 years old, I went to the Apollo and sang on the amateur hour. It wasn't televised then. It was nothing like it is now. But it
And that was Ella's first big break.
Yeah, that was where she really
established herself.
Yeah, and that's where Chick Webb heard her. And then she started doing performances all around Harlem. So that's one thing we had in common. Also, I sang with the Duke Ellington Orchestra under the direction of Mercer Ellington for about 4 years. And everything that he could think of in the Ellington songbook that Ella did, I sang at one time or another. So I knew all the music, you know. I've always scatted. I was always a jazz singer, mm-hmm. even though I've sung tons of other types of material. I sang gospel for years. I've been doing Broadway type songs, you know, that kind of singing for a long time. But jazz is really, you know, the, I guess the platform from which I've sprung.
Mm-hmm. So how long have you been doing Ella, and where are you headed after Tucson?
Well, we started Ella actually last year at Theater Works in Hartford, Connecticut. Robert Giro had this concept to do the show, and I was doing a show called Crowns at Hartford Stage. And he came in, and he met all of us, and he told us about the project that he wanted. He already had it on his season. And he kind of asked, was any of us interested? And I was like, Ella, wow, that's really something. But I really had no idea that I would do a portrayal of Ella Fitzgerald. That was not like in my mind to do. And what happened was several people recommended me after we met. And one of the people that recommended me was Danny Holgate. They just asked me to sing High the Moon, and they hired me.
Well, Tina, that's a great story. Thank you so much for coming down to the studio and telling us about Ella.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
The musical Ella, presented by the Arizona Theater Company at the Temple of Music and Art. For ticket information, visit arizonatheater.org or call 622-2823. And just a quick note for listeners, Mark McLemore will be taking over hosting duties of Arizona Spotlight over the next few months. I'll be away, but I'll make sure to check in from time to time. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood, with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight programs are available online at kuaz.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Julie Burock.